Hello, I'm Guy Garvey, and this is a download of my Desert Island Discs. An absolute privilege for me to be on the programme. I hope you like it. The details of all the tracks I've chosen are on the Desert Island Discs website. The tracks have been shortened because of rights reasons. I hope you enjoy them anyway. Here it is.
My castaway this week is Guy Garvey, frontman of the group Elbow. His voice and lyrics have helped the band win pretty much every music prize going, headlining Glastonbury too, and playing at the closing ceremony of the London Olympics. Yet his image is that of someone who might still be scraping gum off the carpet of Andy's record shop in Bolton, just an everyday, low-key, unassuming bloke, except, of course, that he isn't. He's penning and performing songs filled with intimacy, optimism and lyricism that strike a chord with millions of fans. For a long while, his devotees were well-versed in the art of delayed gratification. Elbow's debut album was released 11 years after the band members first made music together. He writes his songs in his journal and has been keeping a diary since he was 14. Maybe it was the peace and calm of the blank page that first appealed. One of seven kids, he says he was brought up in a house full of women that were singing, shouting, arguing, fighting over the bathroom. I'm ruined by these women. Spoilt rotten. So if you were spoilt rotten then, Guy Garvey, I wonder if that was good training for being a star in the music business.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, getting used to being pampered, absolutely.
The everyman image, how close is it to, are you somebody, you haven't come with an entourage today. We didn't get any riders about sort of only red Smarties and things.
I suppose I do try and maintain it a little bit. I don't wear sunglasses in Manchester. Everywhere else in the world, though, I feel quite comfortable with it.
You've said that when you're inside a song, you're at your happiest. That's when you're inside the process of creating it, is it?
Yeah.
What is it about that you find so enjoyable?
It's like finding your footing in a busy river. It's like knowing your way through something and being amazed that you know your way around. I love music so much, and I still have this sense of wonder when I'm listening to something that somebody else has written. So to be on the inside of that feeling, to sort of still have that feeling of wonder, but it's something that you're creating, it's just addictive.
And even when you are singing about sad things, and often you do sing about very sad feelings, you make it sound beautiful. Is that deliberate?
Thank you. There is a beauty in sadness. There is a calmness in melancholy. I try and find beauty in every feeling, you know.
For people whose life is music, I sometimes wonder if they don't have a very different view of the eights that they want to have. What's been your criteria?
It could have been torturous if I'd let it. I've chosen eight that will actually be a practical aid to my existence on a desert island. These are not my favourite songs of all time. These are ones that would be, in the context of complete solitude, the most handy for survival.
Well, tell me about your first then. What are we going to hear?
Talk, Talk. This song is New Grass. I always say I want it playing at my funeral. And I think it's because I want to make everybody I know sit down and listen to it, that's all. It never fails to get me. It never fails to evoke sapling freshness and springtime. It works any time of year. It's not just a spring record, but it's just the way it picks up and delicately moves around. There's like a very subtle bliss to it.
That was Talk Talk and part of New Grass. So, Guy, Elbow's released six albums to date, the last one going straight in at number one. You have legions of very loyal fans. As I mentioned in the introduction, you've won almost every award going. But even non-fans, I'm sure, will know your song One Day Like This. Mm-hmm. And it has the soaring opening strings. When you do it in concert, everybody knows all the words and sings along. Dawn French and Michael Caine chose it when they came on as castaways. You weren't tempted at all, were you, to choose it?
No, I wasn't.
I'm asking that because I'm wondering if you're sick of it by now.
Really, it's such an enormous tune for us. It's changed our fortunes completely, but also thousands and thousands of people get married to it every year. And it's become something we didn't realise it was going
to
be.
To stand then in a stadium in front of... How many people at Glastonbury did you play to the biggest?
I don't know, upwards of 80,000, 90,000.
Yeah, 90,000 people are looking back at you and singing this song that you were sitting writing in your journal. Is there any way you can convey to us what that experience is like?
It's such a strange thing because the song belongs to the five boys, you know, it belongs to the band, as all our music does. I think that's part of being able to cope with people singing your words back to you. My words are part of what I do with Elbow.
Okay.
I don't feel sole ownership of that song. So it's easy to share with people outside the band, as it is with all our music.
It's time for your second piece of music, Guy Garvey. Tell me about this disc we're going to hear now. What is it and why particularly have you chosen it?
This is Thank You For Talking Me Africa by Sly and the Family Stone. It's an extended, jammed out, slowed down version of one of their big hits. Thank You For Letting Me Be Myself Again. It's important to me because when the band got together and started playing together, none of us could play. And we learnt our instruments and we learnt our craft, if you like, listening to funk music. We played really bad funk music for quite a while we were learning to play. Your immediate sort of goals at that age are to be able to play faster than anyone in the world and as more notes than anyone in the world. And I used to scat. Yeah.
Bold?
It was bold. And then it all slowed down. And at its languid sort of furthest extreme is this song, Thank You For Talking To Me Africa. I can't tell you everything about our leisure pursuits at that time. Yeah, let's just say that our leisure pursuits at the time attracted us to this music.
Right.
And also chocolate.
Sly and the Family Stone and Thank You For Talking To Me Africa. And you were saying just going into that, Guy Garvey, that bound you together, first of all, your musical tastes when Elbow, they weren't Elbow then, but when you got together with your mates and you started playing music. Do you still listen to it now?
It's the last track we listen to before we go on stage, every gig, yeah.
You're on an international tour right now, on the road for a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. The tour bus, what's that like these days?
Well, it varies country to country. The American tour buses are great big chrome things and the front windows go floor to ceiling. So if you sat next to the driver, you feel like you're flying down the highway. Very comfortable these days. Memory foam is a revelation.
You sleep on that, is it? That
yeah,
comfort,
yeah.
Right?
I've got a pillow that remembers my head. It's amazing.
It doesn't sound very sex and drugs and rock and roll. I was hoping for more than that.
There was never sex on the bus. Very impractical. You're separated from the world by a curtain and there's five immediate band members plus our touring crew. You've got at least 13 people on. So if you can have sex in a bunk, then good luck to you.
Right.
Yeah, you'd have to be very small.
So you were born in Bury, just outside Manchester, 1974. Mm-hmm. Your mother... Now, I read your mother had been a policewoman, but she retrained as a counsellor.
She brought up seven children, and then she retrained and became a counsellor, yeah, when we'd all moved out.
Right. And what sort of woman was she and is she?
She is a very bright, very politically engaged, very loving, spiritual woman, very elegant as well. She's... 78, I think she is now, but you wouldn't know it. She's very beautiful.
So you were born the sixth child and you were the first boy.
Yeah.
And as I mentioned in the introduction, born into this, you know, very vibrant, very female household, really. Did you like it? Did you feel at home with all those girls around?
Absolutely. And my brother Marcus was born close enough in age to me that I had my little buddy with me. And when it got a bit much, we could run off and climb a tree, you know.
And your father worked night shifts.
Yeah.
Was that deliberate, to get out of a house full of women with Carmen rollers and all
the
rest?
I've never pondered it. It might well have been.
Tell me more about your dad. What are your memories of him? When you were little, growing up, what was Dad like?
Dad worked very hard. When I was really little, me and my brother would fight over waking him up in the morning. He's 6'4", Dad, and he's a big chap. Enormous hands. We call him Hoth Wampa, which is a Star Wars character with massive hands. because of his night shift work, I'd perhaps see him on a Tuesday. He had a night at home and he'd cut all the fingernails in the house and towel all the hair dry, and we'd watch the two Ronnies or whatever. And then after my mum and dad split up, I actually saw a lot more of him. We had tea at my dad's house every Wednesday and Friday, me and my brother.
You were 12 then, were you?
Yeah, and as is quite often the case, the fact that my mum and dad split and divorced after the initial sadness of that had subsided, I got to know them both as people a lot more, I think, than I would have done otherwise.
These days, when marriages break down, it's very often the case that people will sit the children around the table and talk about it together. It wasn't so much the case, you know, 20, 30 years ago. What happened when your parents split up? How did they explain it to you as a 12-year-old?
It was a case of mum left for a few days, and we knew that she was safe. We knew she was at a friend's house, but they'd had their last argument sort of thing. Mum came back and dad moved out. And I was told I was the man of the house, which was perhaps a bit more responsibility than I needed at that age. But I think probably the best of the thinking at the time to do with a young man. And I was told that my dad would only be a mile down the road and that he'd always be there. And that has proved to be the case, you know. My dad was always working on a friend's car on the path, and he got me my own set of overalls when I was really little. And I used to slide underneath the car with him, and he'd find a random screw on the floor and he'd say, "Find me a washer for that, would you, son?" And I'd end up rooting through these drawers for hours and hours and feeling important, but in retrospect, he was just keeping me busy.
Perfect childminding skills, I would call it.
Yes.
Time for some more music, Guy. We're on your third. Just tell me about this.
This is very much to do with an ongoing friendship with the youngest of my sisters, Becky. She's the Beckypedia on my radio programme on Six Music. She's an authority on music.
Right.
And from being very little, all my sisters played me music, and they all told me why I should like it. But my memories really are of Becky playing me stuff and saying, "Listen to what happens with this piano here, listen to what happens with this harp here." And it was her that made early Genesis, for instance. She made that my nursery rhymes. She made that as magical as it possibly could be. And she's constantly introducing me to new music. I've grown up with Joni Mitchell. She's totally part of the family. And our Becky made me compilations whenever the band were going on tour, right from the first tour. And she was working at Granada TV at the time, and she said, "I've got a compilation for you." And I was like, "Great, I'll come and pick it up." And she said, "I need to be with you when you hear the first song." So I was like, "Why?" And she went, "You'll see." So I met her in Granada Canteen, and I can't remember the actor's voice, but there was a chap on Coronation Street who had a really squeaky voice like
that. Oh, yeah.
Right, so he's at the next table, and I'm finding this very distracting. I'm thinking, oh, it's him, you know. And she puts the headphones on me, and she played this song. And when I recognised the chords, I realised it was a new version of an old favourite.
Yeah.
And I was crying before the first lyric. It's such a nostalgic song in the first place that to hear Joni doing it as an older lady, you feel like you've been with her all that time.
Just before our love got lost, you said, "I am as constant as a northern star."
That was Joni Mitchell, and a later recording of A Case of You. You said, Guy Garvey, that it was important to you that it was that later recording because somehow she brings all of her experience. You can hear it in her voice, hear it in her delivery. And, of course, the lyrics of that are sublime for anybody, I imagine, who writes lyrics. I can't work out about you. I read that you just scraped a C in your GCSE English, and I'm wondering how somebody who just scraped a C could manage to write The Bones of You or all the other extraordinary lyrics that you've written. When did you come to language and come to love it?
I absorb anything I read, I absorb anything I hear. I remember film dialogue like really, really in quite a lot of detail. If something interests me, it goes in and stays in. But I fell out with school age 12.
What happened?
It was around the time my mum and dad divorced, and I remember at the time feeling terribly guilty for using the divorce as an excuse not to do homework and getting away with it. But now as an adult looking back, I think, you know, there's obviously something going on.
Yeah, so it wasn't actually an excuse, it was a reason.
Yes, yeah. But at the time I felt like it was an excuse, I felt guilty, you know.
Were you getting a hard time at school?
Initially at primary school, there was some bullying going on. I mean, never, you know, the kind of awful things you hear about. Not you know, really awful, but bad enough for me not to want to go.
Right, by classmates and people.
Yeah.
You're a big guy. Why would they be bullying the big guy?
I think it's quite obvious to anybody who engages me that I might be big, but I'm not much of a challenge. Somebody looks at me wrong in the street, part of me agrees with them. Like, oh, yeah, what have I done wrong? You know, if they look at me wrong. And I thought everybody felt like that, but people were better or worse at disguising it. But actually, it's only some people who feel like that.
I think a lot of people feel like that. And I certainly think a lot of people feel like that through their teenage years. They feel a sense of inferiority and disconnect. Has that resolved itself for you through all the success and the millions of albums and the adulation?
No, I just catch it now. I've learned how to catch it and control it and steer it and use it to write songs.
So when you feel it on your shoulder or knocking at the door of your head, what do you do these days? How do you marshal it?
I'm currently trying to train myself not to throw whiskey at it. If I've got to do a performance, then I tend to have a drink.
There's a lot of drink in your lyrics.
Yeah, I really enjoy drink.
And I read that 2, 1, 2, 3 G&Ts before you go on stage would be standard.
That's the whole band, yeah. And that's actually...
That's fair enough.
That's conservative as well. Yeah.
When you came in today, I was instantly struck by how very healthy you look. You look
Thank
like
you.
You've lost a lot of weight. You look like there might be a gym involved in your weekly routine. I don't know. Are you consciously trying to sort of not be too boozy or not be too indulgent these days?
Yes, because I want to do it for longer than I could do if I don't curb it a little bit.
So much to talk about. Let's have some music for now, though, Guy Garvey. Tell me what we're going to hear next. This is your fourth.
This is Public Enemy. It's not my favourite Public Enemy song, but it reminds me of my friends. When everyone went to university, I think that was possibly my first heartbreak, because there was a good dozen friends disappeared in one weekend. But they've all come back to Manchester and they're all settled and having families there now. So we still see each other. And if this goes on, nobody keeps their seat, you know, everybody's up. So this will help me on my desert island, picture my mates dancing whenever I want. It's called Give It Up. Quaking, bodies shaking, up a tankin', brains are wrecking, rock, talking, chuck, rocking, flavor, that's shaking. 1, 2, 3, 4. It's another record, check it, magnetist, to put my brothers and sisters on a deathbed. You know he cheated, took what he wanted, and then you bought it. Sucking up to the devil, stepping down a level. It's who they fear is you, who protects us from us and you for you. Yes, and it counts, the 40 hours.
That was Public Enemy and Give It Up. You now, Guy Garvey, I understand, have an honorary doctorate of the arts.
Yes.
Yeah. And the freedom of the town of Bury.
Yeah.
You mentioned about that, you know, that was your first heartbreak, to watch some of your friends, a dozen of them or so, go off to university. You didn't go to university because you didn't presumably have the results, but your sister marched you to sixth form college and said what to you?
Our Gina, I went round to her house, I'm not sure why. She said, what sixth form college are you going to? And I said, I'm not. She was like, you're bleeding out. And she did. She literally marched me up, enrolled me in Stand College in Whitefield. And, yeah, I still didn't go to my classes and things like that. I just sort of... I got kicked out every term, apart from the last one, when two of the GCSEs I resat, I managed to scrape Cs at again. I didn't know what I wanted to do at that age, but I started singing in the common room, showing off initially in any way I could, just being loud and then singing, and that's when I met Mark and the rest of the boys. So it worked.
When you met them, there is that wonderful feeling of somebody feeling like a fish in water suddenly when they're surrounded. It can happen in an office, it can happen on a building site, it can happen in a band, where they think, I'm among my people now.
Oh, yeah. You know, very much so, yeah. It was our first rehearsal was at St. Anne's Church Hall in Tottington in Bury. And Jupp's drum kit was held together with bits of chemistry set, and I didn't have a microphone stand. And we were all going through one tiny little piece of equipment to make a noise of any kind. And I remember, I think we played Johnny B. Goode and the introduction to a Simple Minds song. And we only knew the intro. Don't You Forget About Me, that one.
Right.
So we knew the hey, 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 hey. That's all we knew, that bit. But I remember saying to him, we'll be signed in 6 months.
And... Yeah, how long before you were signed?
Good 7, 8 years, maybe more than that, yeah.
What kept you going?
We thought we were good when we weren't. I'm sure some people would say we're still not.
And obviously you would have to be earning a living? Run through some of the jobs that you had while you were also making music.
I sold double glazing.
See, I read that and I didn't believe it for a minute.
Well, I was very good at it, but my conscience couldn't deal with it, so I didn't do it for very long.
And scraping the gum off the carpet, I think it was on Christmas Eve, wasn't it, in Andy's Records in Bolton?
My lowest ebb, which I've been very lucky in this respect, my mum kicked me out, and then I lived in this party squat for 12 months where I met most of my friends. And then I moved in with my dad for a bit, and that didn't work. He was, I think, enjoying being on his own by that point. So after a few months, I moved in with my sister in Bolton.
Why did your mum chuck you out?
For not attending college. I got yet another letter sent home saying I'd not been attending my lectures, and she booted me out the door. I think she thought I'd come back that night and apologise, and I stubbornly didn't.
You went to the party squad?
I went to the party squad, yeah. I had a great time.
Right, Guy Garvey, we're going to have some more music now. Very much a change of gear, this. Tell me about this.
I was out with my big group of friends on a camping holiday when I was about 22. And I went wandering off into the trees because my ex-girlfriend was among the party, and I was finding it difficult to be around her because I was still in love with her. So I went wandering off through the trees and got lost and ended up halfway up the side of a mountain, thinking I was heading back to the campsite, and I was halfway up this mountain. And I thought, why not finish walking up it and have a look? And as I got to the top, this was on the compilation that my sister Becky had made for me. The Lonely Shepherdess, it's from the Chant d'Auvergne. It's the Bailero, did we decide it was pronounced?
I think it's Bailero.
Yeah, which is kind of French, hey, nonny, nonny.
That was Bailero from Chant d'Auvergne by Canteloube, sung there by Arlene Auger with the English Chamber Orchestra, conducted by Jan-Pascal Tortelier. And for you, lyric alert, are you always sort of chasing a lyric in the same way that, you know, a stand-up will always be chasing a line, that somehow, wherever they are, whatever they're doing, there's a bit of them that really ultimately is engaged in whether or not there'll be a gag? Is there a bit of you that's engaged in whether or not there's a lyric in it?
Yes, at all times, yeah. I got something on the way to the toilet here earlier on about Sasquatch.
So Sasquatch, of course, being Yeti.
Yes. I caught myself in a reflection in exactly that Sasquatch pose.
Right.
So caught myself all Sasquatch, blah, blah, blah. I'll get it in there somewhere.
I'm glad that you brought up the Yeti thing, because when I was thinking of how I would introduce you, I thought about a sort of poetic gorilla. I was going to use that, and then I thought, well, maybe you'd be horribly offended by that, but maybe I'm not the first one. Because you've got that silverback thing going on physically.
Yeah.
Yes.
I've heard worse. Yeah, I get things like this.
I meant it as a compliment,
time.
Actually. I like gorillas.
Oh, well, thank you. I'll take Guy the Gorilla.
Exactly.
I'll take it.
Time for some more music, Guy. This is your sixth. Tell me about your sixth.
Jolie Holland. This is very much a homegrown bedroom record called Catalpa. And she's taken a W.B. Yeats poem and she set it to music. For personal reasons, I really connect with this poem as well. It's a spontaneously occurring story about fish turning into women that's, I think, I suspect has happened in all cultures for all time. Anyway, W.B.
Yeats.
You
can't just laugh. And why are you laughing? What about spontaneously occurring fishy women?
Okay, so me and my friend Ed, when I was about 16, decided to sit down and record a story on a tape cassette. Ed was a keen fisherman, and we wrote this very romantic story about a guy fishing who hooks a carp and it turns into a beautiful girl that he falls in love with, but then she slips away from him. She slips back into the water at the end of the story. Carp Woman, we called it. It could have been... It could have had a better title, but I am in a band called Elbow. And Wandering Angus is pretty much the same thing. He hooks a girl in the form of a trout, and she runs off, and he spends the rest of the time. Of course, his is much better than ours. And I love the line as well. I'm going to paraphrase badly now. And pluck till time and times are done the silver apples of the moon and the golden apples of the sun. That's just beautiful, isn't it?
Beautiful.
I went out to the hazelwood because a fire was in my head. I cut and peeled a hazel wand.
That was Julie Holland and Wandering Angus, and you were talking to me, Guy Garvey, during that about the idea of the muse. You were saying that you subscribe to that idea, that actually you feel you write better when you have a muse.
Certain kinds of songs, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, personal experience is the easiest way, or the easiest place to write from. But if you want to stretch yourself, and if you want to do something that uses your imagination in a different way than just finding the language and finding the poetry or the musicality of your words, then, yeah, to have a muse is a great thing.
And is it that unrequited aspect of it that helps to propel the creativity?
Yeah, because you don't have the boundaries of your experience of that person. You have enough to go on that you can imagine them reacting to anything that you come up with, but you can take them wherever you want. We have a song called An Imagined Affair.
Yes.
I wasn't planning on revealing that the whole thing was imagined in that song. If you were to read the lyrics off the page, it reads like a real thing that happened. And then just in the last verse, I admit that actually I imagined this whole thing, it never happened, and I'm drunk in a bar. But I really enjoyed that little tour of my imagination. But you need somebody in your mind.
When you write the opposite situation, when you write for somebody that you are in a relationship with or you've had a liaison with, do you show them the song? Maybe this is just my fantasy, but I imagine a lot of women have the fantasy that a man is going to write a beautiful song for them.
If it's somebody that I'm involved with at the time of my writing it, then I like to finish it before I play it to them.
Right.
Like, yes, I have gifted people songs.
Right. If you get a reaction that's not the reaction you want, do you junk the song or do you say, too bad it's going on the album anyway?
You don't tell the person that it's about them. So if it doesn't connect with them,
oh,
you've got your out.
What's the best reaction you've ever had?
Oh, make them cry, make them cry.
Let's have our next disc then.
Tom Waits is another of those artists that exists in his own space. And more as the years go on, as he gets more and more experimental and less self-conscious. But this is a return to very simple classic songwriting for him. It's really simple and it's really beautiful. And I understand now that as a songwriter, once you've been doing it for 20 years, you're keen to establish what it is you do that other songwriters don't. And that means falling into the same patterns. It's like guitarists eventually get rid of all the pedals and just have a really simple setup.
So it's sort of like a sense of abstraction. It's like a painter knowing that actually it's all of those choices of what they have left off the canvas.
Yeah.
That makes them what's there important.
Absolutely. Yeah. And sort of, I think this is, it's got everything a Tom Waits song should have. It's got his grizzle, it's got his heart, and the middle eight lyric, I'm gonna love you till the wheels come off, has so many connotations. I absolutely adore it.
The sun come up, it was blue and gold. The sun come up, it was blue and gold. The sun come up, it was blue and gold. Ever since I put your picture in a frame.
That was Tom Waits and Picture in a Frame. So, Guy Garvey, you spent quite a lot of time in recent years in New York, around about the same time as you were about to turn 40, and I'm wondering if the two things were related.
Maybe, yeah. Probably more related to my changing circumstances with Emma. Me and my long-term partner split up last year, sort of coming out the back end of that relationship was like, run away, run away. And also there was a romance to the situation, being quite anonymous in America. We don't do as well over there as we do in Europe. So I could sit in the corner of bars and eavesdrop again. I could listen to conversations around me and also meet people simply on my own merits, like a, you know, like I used to in this country.
Was there a freshness to it? I mean, you used to sit with, you know, the sort of Bob Dylan cap on in the corner of a cafe and write all those years ago before you were successful. Was there a feeling that you were almost reconnecting with that experience?
Yeah, absolutely. And sort of in those terms, sort of 40 hasn't been that scary. I'm quite romantically quite drawn to it. Yeah, I think I'm really, really going to enjoy the next 40 years.
What did you learn about yourself then? Did you learn anything?
Well, you just see yourself from the outside a bit more. I'm not the lead singer of the band out there. I'm not a radio presenter. I'm a polite Englishman in cafes and bars, by and large, inhabited by younger people. So I was watching the waitress who's a photographer flirting with the waiter who's a sculptor, you know, both trying to get their thing off the floor. I was spotting and making parallels with the crew at Night and Day in Manchester Roadhouse that I came up with, all of whom have gone on to do these things, you know, and sort of thinking, God, yeah, I remember that. That was amazing, you know, that part of your life. I'm not much for looking back in any other way than wasn't that great.
Right.
You know, I don't regret any of my decisions, which is quite a thing to be able to say at 40. I don't regret any of my decisions.
What was it like playing in the closing ceremony of the London Olympics 2012? That must have been quite an atmosphere.
It was amazing. We were told it was a dry backstage until 10
no
o'clock.
No booze,
yeah. And I was like, all right, who's saying that? Who's they? And they were like, well, the people producing the closing ceremony. I was like, yes, who are they? What gives them the authority? I got really stroppy, which is not like me. So we ended up smuggling in a case of Guinness, a case of lager, a load of spirits.
How did you smuggle it? And I'm just interested in the logistics of that.
I don't want to get anyone in trouble, but in Madness's flight cases. Them boys are great. I'm sure they wouldn't have minded. In fact, they partook, so there you go.
Right.
But then it was amazing. Word got round that Elbow had the booze, and we had the great and the good from British.
Who did you have knocking at your door?
Brian May knocked on for a beer. And Timothy Spall was my favourite. Me and Tim Spall now are really good buddies. I had a great night with him. And, you know, he had, like, Kate Moss coming up to him and all these wonderful, beautiful models, sort of. And he was still dressed as Churchill and we were well sozzled. And the following day on the train on the way home, I thought, I really like him. I really hope I get to speak to him again. And then I thought, everybody in the country loves Timothy Spall, you know. And then I got home and I got a phone call from him and he went, Guy, old boy, I have to say, it feels like I've known you for 100 years. And I was like, yes! That's my lasting memory of the Olympic closing ceremony.
You've said that you, and you certainly seem to be, you know, a place of transition in your life and a good place in your life. Obviously, the success is there. You're a single man. The world is your oyster. What do you imagine, say, for the next 10 years? What, if I was talking to you when you're 50, where would you like to be in your life?
I don't know. I'm going to concentrate on work. I'm happiest when I'm working. So I'm thinking about writing a book just to see if I can do it. I've realised that trying things and failing at them quite spectacularly, publicly, I'm actually quite drawn to it in a twisted way. So I'm just going to try stuff. And if somebody comes into my life that changes the rules and knocks me on the head, then brilliant. But I'm really enjoying being single. I'm really enjoying having my freedom and my time to myself.
Let's have your final track, Guy Garvey. What are we going to hear?
This is Jonah's Policewoman. The song's called Real Life. It's exquisite. It's one for Emma Jane, who thus far is the love of my life, and it reminds me of the best part of that relationship. It reminds me that for every romantic notion, there are 10 practical things to take into account, and that's what actually makes up life and relationships.
Was Jonah's Policewoman and Real Life. So, Guy Garvey, I'm going to give you some books now. You get to take the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare to the island and one other book too. What will it be?
I wonder if there's a complete J.D. Salinger. Can I have it, if there is?
If there isn't, what
would you have?
If you had to pick one.
It'd have to be Raise High the Roofbeam Carpenters. That's my favourite compendium of his short stories.
Okay. If it exists, the complete works, you can have it. If it doesn't, you can have that single one. And a luxury item too. What will that be?
See, I'm torn here between a radio and a case of scotch.
Well, it's an easy choice because I wouldn't give you the radio.
And we're not allowed a radio?
Oh.
How did I miss that? How, are you just being cruel today, or...?
You're allowed 8 discs. That's the listening
course,
material.
Right, yeah. I see.
It's the scotch, is it?
Well, I say scotch, it's Irish whiskey, actually.
Oof.
I know, I'm sorry.
Now I'm going to get tough with you. No, what is it? Which one?
Just a nice, simple, basic one, like Bushmills.
Right, lovely, yeah. Okay. You could have an endless supply if you want.
Can I?
Yeah.
What about ice? Could I have ice as well?
I think you can.
Oh, I love it, right.
If you're going to ruin a good whiskey,
can I go now?
Which one of these 8 would you pick if you were to save one from the waves? Which one would it be?
I think it'd be Talk Talk. It'd be Newgrass.
Okay, it's yours. Guy Garvey, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.